Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under The Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course. To the Carpcast, introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chops. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
Ooh, yeah.
So hello and welcome to episode 54 of the Carpcast. How are we doing, Mark?
I'm rather well, to be honest. Just set the scene for where I am right now. I'm sat in my bivvy. Well, I said looking out over the lake, but there's too many trees. I've got like, I'm like blinking into my little corner. But it's a corner where the fish turn up. There's three nice sexy traps set down there, and I might get a run live.
So you're on there on your syndicate. You had a fish yesterday as well, didn't you?
I did. Out to midday. From the round the corner, the far margin, the slope, and I've got a couple of liners. I was stood right next to the rods and it went round. I honestly cannot remember the last time that happened. So I was literally just there. But dare I also say, I was using slack lines.
Was it a spot that required slack lines?
It was one of the few situations that I'm fishing to quite a steep far margin, so I don't want my line going straight across this bay like a bowstring. Far cast, I'm talking 30 yards at the most.
Yeah, no weed.
So there's a touch around the edge, like a little trim, but not a great deal. And you know what? I still had a bit of problem. Where the line went down, it caught on something, or branch something down there. But there was a point where the line pinned free of that, went totally slag. I lost the fish till I wound down and found it there. And slack lines, I'm not using them now, not as slack anyway. I still want the line going kind of like from the lead down the ledge and then back to me. But, you know, we live and learn. It's a constant learning curve. Especially the first fish I've caught that's been on a bottom bait rather than over about 100 years.
Wow. So if there's a very good possibility you might catch one live. It's 9 a.m, which is bite time. I don't know what bite times are in there. Are they like daytime bites or nighttime bites or both?
Yeah, my last two fish out of here have both been around midday. Now, that'll be another one to record, but there's always a good shout. What I did do yesterday morning, first light, was redid everything and rebaited with quite a lot of bait on that spot I caught from, to be honest. It's not been fishing well, so I filled it in. No, it's something that can sometimes, you know, just switch them on, and it did.
Yeah, cool. Well, I've done quite a bit of fishing over the last weeks, most of it on Nash Royston Lake, where we had our social. The second Carpcast social was at Kevin Nash's new Royston complex. It is a complex, there's a couple of lakes there, and what a fantastic job they've done of it. You pretty impressed with it? I know all the lads that came where. We took 21 lads plus the people that were working. Spenny came, and yourself and myself, so it was like probably 25 of us in total. Richard from Fired Up Barbecues and his pal were there, and it was a thoroughly good weekend.
It was really, really enjoyable, and probably the best thing, there was, how many fish was there caught? It was about 30 odd, something like that.
Yes, yeah, there were certainly plenty of carp caught. Biggest, I think Spenny had the biggest the night before everybody arrived at 28. Was it Sean that got off to an absolute flyer? To set the scene of the lake, they're like two chalk pits. Yeah. One's quite long, the other one's like round with like a couple of like little corners, bays sort of thing. It's very intimate. The lake's deep, and all the spots are in the edge. I persevered with open water, but it's like, it's chalk, but it's like clayey chalk, and I found out in the middle, like the bottom doesn't smell very nice. But 99% of all the fish caught were within, I would say, probably 6 or 8 foot of the bank. The margins are very deep, like double figures, straight off the edge. And there, it's quite snaggy, you know, there's overhanging trees and bushes, and just looks very carpy, doesn't it? And pretty much all the fish were caught around the edges. I went there the following weekend as well for the Nash Roadshow and like the open weekend, and it was exactly the same. There was quite a few fish caught, and they were all caught around the edges. Super interesting. It's a little bit of an unknown quantity. We don't know what fish are in there yet. On the following weekend, there was a 31 caught. That's not a fish that anyone knows, I think. Obviously, they've stocked it with hundreds and hundreds of really nice scaly linears and fully scaled, and you know, the sort of very high quality stock carp that you see these days when people spend a few quid on stockings. You can see a lot of those, but the original stock, I mean, I spoke to a lot of people that have fished that lake for like 25, 30 years. There was quite a few people came to the open day that, you know, had fished it when it was like the club lake for many, many years, and got quite a lot of info about the lake. Dennis McFetterich was a regular down there many years ago, and there's rumours that it did a 40 in the 1980s.
Oh, wow.
Fish obviously long gone now, but the lake's really got some history. I had a chat with a few very interesting people. It's definitely done fish to mid-30s, you know, back in the day. Like I say, it's thrown up a few 30s now. Obviously, there's been fish put in there as well. I know there's a, you know, scraper 40 in each lake, common in the Long Lake, and a fish called Lumpy in the New Lake, which one of the lads off our Carpcast social, Sean, who got off to an absolute flyer on the social, he had about 8 fish and lost a few. He was so he loved the lake so much, he booked on through nashlakes.com, went on and fished this weekend just gone, and ended up catching Lumpy, spawned out weight of 35 something. Kevin rang me at the weekend actually to give me this story on the fantastic wood carving common that came out of the Cops Lake last week, which if you're a member of the official Carpcast fan page, you'll see pictures and a video of it on there. The lad that caught it is obviously a Carpcast listener, and he went on there and posted a picture of an amazing common, 58 something it was, 58.10 I think. Kevin rang me to tell me about that, and said that the fish had been spawning again on Royston. The day that I went down there after the Carpcast social, we finished on the Sunday night, we went home. I came back on the Wednesday. I did a tuition with one of my friends, swapped a bit of knowledge for knowledge, and fishing knowledge for his other knowledge, and it was red hot. It was like 27 degrees when we got there, and the fish were chasing each other about a bit then, and it went pretty cool after that, and really heavy winds, quite a bit of rain, so like they dropped again. But when we first got there was like 5 or 6 fish under every single bush, and they were tightly grouped and, you know, pushing each other around. It was super warm, and then it went cool again, and having spoke to a couple of other people who own lakes, there's a few lakes that have had another go at spawning this last week, so that explains the £35, because I know Alan had had that Lumpy fish. Alan Blair had had it a few weeks ago at 38 something, so they've definitely had another go at spawning. No signs of that on the scene, them having another go on there.
No, but it wouldn't surprise me if they did, because they spawned a couple of weeks back and you just made my syndicate. But not to worry.
I've got it out, don't worry.
No, I got down for a day session. It would be about 3 weeks ago now, and they were all spawning around the edge. There has been a couple of fish out since. You know, one, like, I think it was last week, it was out at 41, which is, I believe, its top weight. So not all of them have emptied out.
Well, that's odd, that, isn't it? Do you think it's different strains of fish spawn at different times? I've heard the theory of when people stock lakes, they stock two or three different strains because the fish tend to spawn together. So, especially if you've got a commercial lake or a day ticket lake or something, you might find one group of fish spawning in one corner. And the rest of the stock are fine, you know, just elsewhere doing whatever fish do. Have you noticed? I've noticed on many lakes they spawn in different groups, but do you think it's groups of like their own kind, like of a certain strain, or the big ones and the small ones?
We don't like to interbreed.
Fishist.
Fishist. I don't know exactly what you're saying, but I don't know, I'm going to lean more towards it might be different age groups.
Yeah,
like
I can get that.
Fish, younger, young teenagers are horny and just want to shoot the load. and your old ones, probably like us now, just think, gosh, I suppose I better. And finally get it done with.
Yeah, maybe. Going back to the Carpcast social, we have got another social coming up. Is it the 8th of October that weekend? It's certainly the second weekend
it
in October.
Yeah.
And it's on Christchurch with the legendary Mr. Frank Warwick. I believe you're not going to be there now, Mark. I believe it's your wife's 40th who's booked a trip away. So unfortunately, you're not going to be there.
I don't do a lot anyway. I'll not be missed.
You'll be missed cooking breakfast in the morning when I'm trying to make breakfast for 20 people.
You'll love it, I'll be eating great big greasy cinnamon rolls and strong coffee for breakfast. Although she's booked us to go away in Florida. She's looking at all these what's going off over there because it's a 40s. You know, she wants to make a big thing of it. I told you he was performing at Hard Rock Live the day we get there.
You've mentioned it. You better tell everybody else, though.
Yeah, Slayer. Mm. So my wife's 40th birthday holiday is going to start with a gig of a band she hates.
Yeah, so the Carpcast social will be going on as normal.
Yeah.
It's Frank Warwick's going to be there all weekend. If you want a hint of what goes down, you can have a look at the previous one. If you're a Carpcast Extra member, we did put the Alan Blair Q&A up on the website, carpcast.com. You can also join to be an extra member there. We finally will have some releases of the new episodes of the Carpcast Extra. We'll have them out this week. We can tell you the guests as well, can't we, Mark? You've been busy interviewing people. We have a few fishing A-listers answering the questions or telling the stories that we put to them. Carpcast Extra is different to the normal Carpcast. It's basically stories. There's no adverts. There's no general chit-chat about, news or anything. It's all stories, educational or entertainment-based. And from what we do, we get a group of anglers together. This time it's Chile. Who else we got, Mark? Ian McMillan.
We've got three Ians with Ian Chilcott, Ian Ross, Ian Ting Tong, Mr. McMillan. There's also Steve Briggs. I spent a wonderful couple of hours recording with Adam Penny.
Yes, Dave Lane was supposed to be on there, and that's one of the reasons for the delay. We hope to get him on this lot, and he's just been extremely difficult to get hold of. He keeps saying he'll do it, and then when you say, okay, Dave, are you free, he ignores us, and that must have happened 8 times. So I apologise for the delay. The people that subscribe yearly, you're not going to miss any episodes. We are going to catch up with them. Unfortunately, Dave Lane's not going to be on it because we've given him quite long enough, and we know you guys have been really patient waiting for the next lot of extras, and unfortunately he's held us up, as have one or two other people. But we're just going to put it out with the content that we've got, because we know it's dragged on for ages, and unfortunately it was a little bit out of our control. But man, yep, you can subscribe yearly to the Carpcast Extra, or you can buy the whole packages. I think it's $7.99, was it, for the first package, which was John Matt, Kevin Nash, Alan Blair, Daryl Peck. Who else was on the first batch?
Ronnie DeGroote,
yes, and Frank Warwick, who's some of the Frank Warwick stories are absolutely fantastic. So that's the first group. Like I say, you can buy them as a group. They all answer the same, they all tell us the same stories, you know, like the one that got away, and their best ever capture, and it's basically just a lot of good stories from some very interesting people. And that's what we're doing with the Carpcast Extra. The new group of people will be out from this week. Cheapest way to get access to all that is to pay for a year, which is £35. We thank you to the hundreds of people that have already done that. As I said, we throw up extra content on there as well from time to time. The Julian Cundiff Q&A from the Cromwell Carpcast social, that's up there, as is the Alan Blair one from this current social. And what a legend Alan is. I mean, he had time for everybody, didn't he, at the Royston social. He spent hours with people all day long, going round their swims, chatting to him. We then had the fantastic barbecue with Richard, fired.barbecues.co.uk. There's links in on our page and stuff. If just have a look at the pictures, the food is always amazing. And there was a lot of fish caught, and Alan's just a legend, isn't he?
And he doesn't skip leg day, does he?
No.
Yeah, we've got to tell a story about. I've seen the video that is on our Facebook page, which I think is about 22,000 views now. It has been shared quite a lot and people tagging it quite a lot. But yes. We're actually recording the video before where Jamie here is, you know, just basically talking about the social and the barbecue. Alan's giving a captivating talk of his van on his things. And then I lost reception literally seconds before Jamie's receiver burst to life in his pocket. I'm thinking I'm still recording as we're all running into Jamie's swim. You know, this is literally everybody, you know, 20, like a herd of elephant carters tramping down the bank. And you hooked a fish on there. It was quite a long zig, wasn't it?
Yeah, so what had happened, there was a few fish showing in open water. I think what had happened is the wood lake hasn't been fished before. There's a couple of people fished it on promo videos for Nash and Alan, and fished it a few times over the last couple of years, but basically it's not been fished. So 20 odd anglers turning up, the fish, they did get a bit scared. They shot into one bay, which is where Sean bagged up. You know, they took cover, and a lot of times they just moved into the middle, like in the deep water. I attempted to fish for them out there, couldn't get a bite off the bottom, but I decided all day on the Saturday just to work an area over a zig. Heapy Bob, who runs the official Carpcast page, he's got some really top of the range bait boat with a mega echo sounder that he'd bought on the way up to the Carpcast. He'd seen it on a for sale site and didn't want to miss the opportunity of getting this boat. So he's like driving it around the middle of the lake, playing with it, trying to get used to it, and it kept showing fish up at 15 foot depth in 21 foot of water, like right in front of me and him. So I put a 15 foot zig out on the Saturday morning, and doing the usual, I made a sinking floating sort of cloudy spod mix, load of riser pellets in it, a load of cloudy spod mix, and I kept spotting, you know, every 20 minutes I was banging three or four spots over the top of the sig. Did this all day and didn't catch. Pretty much forgotten about it. We went to get the barbecue underway, which was like right behind my swim in kind of the central area, and as I said while you were recording that video, I had a screamer. I had no idea which rod it was, and when we got down there, it was the zig rod. So it's on a 15 foot zig, which, as you will know, is quite tricky to land a fish. You're using a 12 foot rod and a 15 foot zig. Obviously we've got a swim full of people, and Alan said to me, do you want to get on my shoulders? So I jumped up on Alan's shoulders, and Andrew was videoing this in the Peg, the Scottish lad that comes to all the socials. He's got a fantastic video of the fish like turning in the water and then me getting on Alan's shoulder and then landing the fish. And it was a great moment, wasn't it? It was just the icing on the cake for an absolutely fantastic weekend. And you know, like I say, the video's had 22,000 views just over last week. Which is, you know, it's brilliant. I mean, the first video where Sean caught a fish, like literally an hour or two into the social, and the Nash Tackle page shared that. I mean, that had like 15,000 views overnight, virtually, you know, certainly over the weekend. This Alan one is a pretty funny video. Big cheer as the fish goes in the net. And it was just a great way. Great way to kind of round off a fantastic weekend. We had a lot of drinks and food on the Saturday night. It was my birthday. Thank you very much to everyone who's involved in making me a Carpcast birthday cake. It was fully, I don't know how they do that. How do they print our logo onto icing? What was it?
I have no idea, but the fella I work with, Martin Renfrey is called, it was his good lady cake. They're going to hate me now because I've totally forgot the name. But Joe, I get to hear this, so big thank you for that one.
Yeah, thank you.
The sparklers they burnt down in longer than it took us to actually light them.
Yeah, it was an absolutely fantastic weekend. Go and check out the videos on the Carpcast page, you can see and get involved. There are places left. We haven't started selling the October Christchurch tickets again. It's exactly the same script. We've got a guest angler there doing talks and doing some coaching with you. We've got Richard there with the barbecue, fired up barbecues for the Saturday night. We'll have a few drinks, and as you know, Christchurch is an absolutely amazing lake. It's not very big, it's all quite short range work. I mean, it's only like, it's about 12 14 wraps to the middle of the lake, and there's at least 20 40s in there with one or two pushing 50 pound, which may go 50 this year. And we've got.
I don't tell the wife, but I'd actually rather be.
You'd rather be fishing, of course.
Right, I would.
If you would like to book on for that, the price is $250 for the weekend. You get food, you get breakfast, baps, bomb cakes, rolls, whatever you call them in your area, breakfast things on the Saturday and Sunday morning, and obviously beer and food on the Saturday night, plus your permits for the weekend, everything you need. And I know a couple of the lads from the Royston trip have signed up already. But there's plenty of places left. This is the first time we're actually officially selling the places for that trip. So if you'd like to get involved, then get in touch with Mark Watson on Facebook or message us through the Carpcast page, and then we'll get you booked in. DNABaits.com, Mark. DNA have been a proud sponsor since we started the Carpcast, and you can get extra discounts with them when you check out off everything they do on their website, and you can use the code CARPCAST5 at the checkout and get a 5% discount. They do fluoro pop-ups, post-free deals, the fluoro candy sticks, post-free deals, fluoro wafters. Basically, they do lots of post-free deals where you order direct and it's delivered straight to your door. In a package, they do the boilie packs, they do 5 key deals. There's a couple of different options for that, including the boilies of your choice and hook baits. £45 for a 5 kilo deal, or £55 and you get an extra choice of liquids to accompany it. There's 10 kilo deals, even 50 kilo boilie deals, where you get 50 kilos of freezer bait. You can split it into a couple of different sizes if you wish. You get matching cork dust wafters, cork dust pop-ups, hydro wheat or beta stim, and it's only £320 delivered to your door. Some of the DNA baits are absolutely fantastic. A couple of my pals use the S7 and they really love it, the Secret Seven. Fishes all year round, that bait. I have smelt it. I do like that bait. I have to say it's a pretty nice bait. The Switch is the one everybody's talking about this year, which is their latest bait. But go onto the website, dnabaits.com, and check out all the great offers that they have. And don't forget to use the code CARPCAST5 at the checkout for an extra discount. Pinpoint Hooks, Mark, tell us about them.
They caught me a fish yesterday.
Yeah.
That's all I'll tell you about them. Yeah, it was actually one of the, when they sent me the stuff over, with some of their, there's also some twisters that had sharpened up for us.
That's right, yeah, I found mine the other day actually, and I was using them at Royston.
Yeah, but it was one of those, and yeah, little, could I put, like I say, a lot of hemp went down there as well as me usual KS boilies, so shutting down to a 3-inch hook bank, and it was still hooked an inch back.
Was it?
Yeah, absolutely nailed. But when you get a hook point that is that needle sharp, you know, they don't get a chance to eject it. They only have to, like, you know, just catch, and both, game over.
Yeah,
they still gonna land them, but you know what I mean, they're hooked. But the hooks that they have sharpened, they're hand sharpened on a unique one of a kind machine, a microscope. So you've got a new standard of hook sharpness straight out the pack for those ones. They do their own next gen hooks, which they sharpen that way. Or you can even send your own hooks to get that sort of treatment. But also, like Sean won for his 26 pound. That was his biggest at the Royston Social. He run one of the sharpening kits they have that they sent us for prizes, and I've totally forgot the name. Who won the one on Kingfisher Lake?
Yeah, I never knew who that was actually. Who caught the biggest? What was the biggest fish on that lake caught that weekend?
I was only about 18 pound. There were none of the monsters out.
Yeah, it's very
definitely bigger fish seen.
Yeah, it's very nice of Mark at Pinpoint Hooks to donate a couple of the sharpening kits for us for the Royston Social. So basically, we gave a pack away for the biggest fish on each lake, and the sharpening kit consists of like a magnifying glass with the LED light on it. It has the clamp vice thingy to hold it. It's got various two different sizes of file, which are very large, like quite a wide base on it. So anybody that's finds sharpening hooks a bit too fiddly, this makes it a lot easier. They're a lot wider than the other files that I've seen on the market, the diamond files. Nice chunky what they call the stones for, like touching
like
them up at the end,
stone sort of thing.
And I'll tell you what, I hadn't actually used. You get three colours of permanent marker pen in the pack.
Yes, you do.
Now, I hadn't been using those. When I've been sharpening my hooks for years now, just because I'm tight and lazy and don't like tying new rigs. So I just basically touch up the rigs that I've got, which makes a packet of hooks last forever. But what I'm finding is that obviously once you sharpen them, they go rusty when they've been in the water overnight, and they were going really rusty on Royston. I mean, it's maybe 70, 80 years old chalk pit, and it was going extremely rusty, but more than normal lakes. And then I looked at these marker pens that I'd ignored in my Pinpoint's hook sharpening pack, and it actually says on them anti-corrosion. I thought it was just a cover, but I didn't realise it was for anti-corrosion. So I started using them, just colouring the point in with the end of the felt tip marker, and it worked. It completely stopped the rusting, and I like sniffing pens, so I like the smell of them. So you get three different colours in there, although they all look pretty much the same by the time you've coloured it up. But it definitely works. I used to just use Vaseline to just coat the point with after I'd sharpened them, if I could be bothered. But these pens really do the job. They certainly work. And again, you can get a 10% discount on all the Pinpoint Hook stuff. You can find them at www.pinpoint-hooks.co.uk, and you can use the code CARPCAST10 when you check out, and you'll get an extra 10% discount on all the sharpening kits, all the hooks, all the stuff that they sell on the website. They are a German firm, and they're set up an English website just for all you UK guys. Mark's a very well known angler, extremely competent, and I know they're pushing themselves in the UK quite a bit more. He's been in touch with me this week about a stand at the Northern Angling Show as well. So thanks to Mark for supporting us, thanks for donating the stuff that he's done, and please go and check out his website, pinpoint-hooks.co.uk, and have a look at all the gear that he sells for yourself.
Yeah, and if you're a retailer who's thinking about stocking some hook sharpening kits, go and have a look yourself and get in touch. Matt will help you out.
Yeah, he's looking for UK retailers, so yeah, check it out, pinpoint-hooks.co.uk. What are we moving on to next? Have you seen anything on the net, Mark?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Well, I hesitated to put this in the notes, but the old slackline is too...
It's
been a bit boring now, to be honest.
We made a comment on a previous show about... who was it?
Young lad, was it? Elliot Gray. It really Elliot. Like old people posted it to us and basically wanting us to comment because we, knowing that we'd disagree with what he'd written, and we did. And so he came back and it seemingly quite aggressively with his post, saying we were digging him out.
Yeah,
what
I don't
does
know
that mean?
I don't know what digging him out means, but I assume it's Southern for having a pop. We did have a kind of a pop, and it's very tongue-in-cheek. I mean, most of our opinions on it, we're not really fussed about, you know, it's content for the show, but do I ever think about it the second we switch the mic off? No, probably not. About pretty much everything we discuss, you know, it's not like it's the be-all and end-all, but I know he obviously wrote an article saying that he uses slack lines wherever he can, and most people know that we have
we'd rather know what's going off on the other end.
Yeah, we did a slack lines as carper not sheep. We haven't done a carper not sheep for ages, have we? We need to do one. But
carp and not sheep,
obviously carp are not sheep was basically a tongue-in-cheek pop at you know, people that follow trends, you know, like the folded reel handles and all that sort of stuff, just stuff that's probably useless, but you know, just a bit of a carp fishing trend. So slack lines was obviously one of those, because I've seen people fishing slack lines in ridiculous situations. We've had people like Rob Hughes on who've done the underwater diving, and you know, they basically said slack lines are a complete waste of time, more than sort of 20 yards out, and you've got to have like zero weed in the lake, and conditions have got to be right for using slack lines, basically. But it started a debate. People shared Elliot's article to us, and then all Elliot's fans, obviously Elliot's a popular guy, he's with Corda, who have got very strong marketing regime. Elliot made that post, a load of people commented on it, and me and Elliot were having banter. I had a number of messages back and forwards privately with Elliot, and he's coming on the show. He's just away at the minute. Yeah. He just proposed to his girlfriend live on a video while on holiday currently, so congratulations to Elliot. And he's going to come on the show as soon as he's back, so he's just going to debate it. But him and me we're just laughing, you know. Everyone else is getting dead serious about it, and you know, we're bantering with each other basically, and he seems like a decent lad, and it's all in good faith, so I'm sure he's going to come on, and let's have a live debate about the benefits of slack lines. I think the only I said tongue in cheek that you know, it's no coincidence that Corda sell a slack line bobbin and he only uses slack lines, which was kind of tongue in cheek. It was a little pop, but you know, that's the way of the world. You know, I use Nash buzzers because I'm with Nash, but they are pretty damn good, you know. But that's
like Nash bobbins that you can't see.
Yeah, I like my bobbins. They look very nice, especially with the purple isotopes in them. They look sexy. Anyway, yeah, it's all in good faith with Elliot, and it was tongue in cheek. You know, I've no personal problem with Corda or Elliot or anybody really, but Elliot's going to come on the show and we shall debate slack lines amongst other stuff, including his live proposal to his girlfriend. We'll have a chat with him about that in a week or two. Anything else on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yeah. Do you know about the unfortunate German swimmer?
Somebody shared this to me. I didn't go too deep into it yet, but
apparently, I wish you had not gone too deep either.
So basically, a German nudist swimmer got a hook stuck in his knob or penis, or whatever you'd like to call it. And shouts.
Depends on the temperature of the water, I suppose.
Shouts to the anglers, don't reel in! You couldn't swim fast enough, could you?
No. It does make you wonder, though, because I can think of only two scenarios in which you're going to get a hook in your knob. Either it's a zig rig.
Yeah.
Or this German fellow is extremely well endowed and it's dragging on the lake bed.
Yeah, unless they were already reeling when it caught him. I don't know. Unless he's gone over and caught the line. Maybe he's caught the line with his legs or something and pulled it up.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how the fellow was fishing anyway, but he was. He swam back to the bank. You know, couldn't get the hook out, cut the line, and cycled back home before seeking medical attention. I'm sure that's one that the German A&E staff will talk about for quite a while.
Oh, I'm cringing already thinking about it. Just imagine that, yeah. Right through the meat. Oh!
Oh.
That's
every last pothole you feel on your bike.
Let's move on. I believe you were out on the bank interviewing recently.
Yes, well, following on the roasting sofa, carried on, had a little adventure, drove straight down to Farlow's, did a quick, was it a cheeky or quick overnighter? It's probably a cheeky one because I went there mainly so I could have a shower in the morning. And met up in the OMM offices, which is like O'Neill Modern Media. The fellow who runs that, Mike O'Neill, is behind LA Carp. A meeting with the people and have an introduction as well. And, met John Baker and John Llewellyn. And, wow, the information and knowledge they have on carp bait and carp behaviour is absolutely mind-blowing. And with, Ray Pulford, we did an overnight on Lucity Lake down that sort of area. And I got an interview with John Baker on the bank. So, let's see what he had to say. Feels like I'm in love. Just had the first time I met you. Yeah, yeah. Feels like I'm in love. Just had the first time I met you. It's Carpcast chats. Don't call them interviews anymore. They're more just relaxed chats. I'm sat here with someone who's got a lot of history in the carp world, and actually was texted his number by Frank Warwick. And if Frank Warwick wants to hear what this man has to say, then I think we should all listen. So I'd like to welcome John Baker. How are you, John? You're looking well.
Yeah, I'm feeling good. Nice sunny evening. Sitting by the lake. It's very nice to be asked to have a chat. I've got no idea what you'd like to talk about, but I'm fairly fairly open-minded to anything.
Yeah, we'll try and stick to fishing, and the chats just go wherever they go. But, we'll start off. How did you get into carp fishing? Because this is back in the days before social media, before carp fishing boomed. What was a carp like? The mythical creature that nobody could catch.
Well, it was. I am that old. it was a mythical creature. At the time, if we saw any pictures of carp, we thought, well, we'll never catch anything like that. And our heroes of the day were people like Jack Hilton and Richard Walker, who'd obviously, we'd heard about their exploits at Redmire Pool, where the record carp was caught. I think that was caught in, the very early 50s. I was born in 1954, so I didn't really get into any serious fishing until I was about 10. And so that would be the early 60s. And getting into carp fishing, I only got into that when I was about 15, when some people turned up at a club lake I was in Hertfordshire. And the lake was called, I won't say the name of the lake, because the club's still going. But anyway, it was a lovely club lake, typical sort of well-established club lake. And these two guys came in the car park, and I'd been roach fishing or something for the day, and they turned up with two rods which were one piece 10-foot rods clipped to their roof rack.
Yeah.
I thought, well, if anybody's prepared to be as specialist as that, then I want some of that. You know, that was really specialist, and only a few people fished in what was called the carp pit, you know. And
carp pit, I love that.
Yeah, no one had talked to you, you know, they all sat under their brawlers with flat caps, you know, and looking very serious.
Yeah.
So it was, it appealed to the quirky side of my nature to do something which didn't follow the norm, which I suppose is something which has followed me right through my angling career, you know, to not follow the norm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you follow the norm, you're only going to catch the norm. You know, it's an old adage, but can you remember your first ever carp, what it felt like when you felt that power for the first time?
I can, actually. And my first ever carp came from a beautiful little lily pad covered pool in the middle of Epping Forest called Copt Hall, which used to be the Queen Elizabeth's hunting lodge. And the actual house itself burnt out many, many years ago, and the pool was only about 3 or 4 acres, and it smelled of carp. It was like something from one of BB's books, you know, the old copper mine or something like that. And you could go there and watch the carp heaving underneath the lily pads, and if you cast a piece of crust on top of the lily pads and dragged it to the edge, with any luck, before the ducks got it, you'd catch a carp. And I caught one about 5 pounds, and it was a wildie, an English wildie, and I was just blown away by its power, you know, compared to the roach and chub that I've been catching on the River Lee. So that was my first introduction to carp.
Yeah, I think that's something we can all relate to, just pulling the float of the crust, whatever it is, back to the edge of the pads, hoping those big rubber lips come up.
Yeah.
If that doesn't excite you, then get a golf club. But so was that bug then? Did you go straight into carp then, or was it?
No, I was in a club, obviously not being able to drive. I was in a club before I passed my test where we used to go off every weekend and go and fish at a different water as part of the club, you know, affiliated club. You go to the River Thames 1 week, or Lemway Pits in Norfolk was a place we went to, and different places, and we'd have a match, we'd fish a match. And then gradually I met carp anglers on these weekend meetings, and I thought, no, I want some big fish, and that's what got me into it. So I started to become more specialist, and I left that club and joined a proper club with proper fish in it.
And I was pretty similar, because I was fishing on the local canal, and instead of, I'd leave the pole in the bag and I'd be always far bang for the chub, and then tension again on that long pond, it was called. It's like an old stretch of the River Don where it was diverted, you know, by some Dutch people years back, and I saw a couple of people carping on there, and it was, well, dare I speak to them? And, you know, I did, and then a couple of mates got into it, and I thought, well, if my mates are doing it, I want to catch more than what they do, because that's just what I am, that competitive streak. But
it's funny, when you're a young lad, you know, and you're a bit in awe of people, you know, they've got all the lovely gear, and, you know, I suppose they're a bit, you know, some of them are old enough to be your dad, and you don't really want to even go up and talk to them. I was actually quite lucky. I met up with a pal of mine who, I don't know whether he felt sorry for me, but he opened up to me with the tactics he was using and the methods, and he gave me some good help on, you know, what line to buy. And I can remember feeling very intimidated going into the fishing tackle shop, which my local shop was called Don's of Edmonton in North London. Very good shop, very experienced people. But I used to be nervous going in the shop and asking for gear, you know, because I didn't really know what I was talking about. And this pal of mine, Len, his name was, Len Barker, actually, that's his name, smashing guy. Haven't been in contact with him for years, and I would love to get in contact with him. So if anyone's in contact with Len Barker, who lives in Cheshunt, I'd love to speak to you, Len. And he helped me a lot. When you have a mentor, somebody to help you, it's a massive, massive boost to the confidence, because you can bounce ideas off each other. And none of my pals at the time that were carp fishing, when I started and started to get successful when I was 16 and 17, and they'd come off the rivers chubbing on the River Lee and started to concentrate on carp, and they joined me, then it really became interesting because we could start to be a bit more competitive.
Yeah, yeah. And my mentor back then was the Angling Times and Angler's Mail. You know, didn't really compare notes with friends because I didn't want to give anything away. I'd got that competitive straight away. But how competitive when we used to poke fish on the canal? I wanted to catch more. And, you know, I'd like, if I knew we were going fishing, we had a Willagarth, a local lake. You know, it's the only one. In fact, it was when they had the old close season, they put trout in so they could stay open.
Oh, well, I remember that.
Yeah, I remember that because we still used boilies. It was like worm and maggot only. But we used to use a little piece of spaghetti for a hair stop so you could strike the boilie off if you came down to check you. But, yeah, that's nothing I was going to ask, getting back to you. How easy was tackle to come by back then? Because obviously this is before the boom. You know, what was available to you?
Well, it was before the boom, and there was no specialist tackle, obviously no internet. Tackle shops were very much geared up to sort of typical club anglers. So any specialist carp gear, well, there really wasn't any. So you had to make a lot of your own gear. I made my own landing net. I made in metalwork at school. I can remember the teacher saying to me, "What on earth are you making there?" You know, when you were allowed to have a project to make, and I made a pair of rod rests in metalwork using the school's stock of metal. And I had those rod rests for absolutely years, and I think I left them on the bus.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That'd be something. Yeah. You've just like my wooden stick I've had for years for mixing this stuff up. So
yeah, I saw that. I would have kept them, yeah. I have actually got some old green rod rests, which I definitely remember buying when I was in my late teens, and I've still got them.
Yeah, I don't think I've... well, there's plenty of tackle I've had in the past that I wish I'd have kept.
But it's when you feel sorry for people, although it's not a very bright subject to talk about, I suspect you've had it, and I've definitely had it in my lifetime, when people have had their tackle stolen, and they have their favourite gear, all your little bits that you keep around you, you know, your little sentimental bits and pieces, you know, your box or whatever it is, and that all that goes. It's irreplaceable. Yeah, so I always feel sorry for people, because you can go and buy new rods and reels and get the insurance claim, but you can't replace those little bits and pieces that you might have made, you know.
You can't get me a new mixing stick.
No, I can't get you a new mixing stick.
But, let's get back to brighter places, you know, you're chasing this car. How are you tracking down venues with bigger car to try and target? Because there's no Facebook, there's no social media, and I suppose magazine reports are pretty... thin on the ground, are they?
Well, magazine reports that there weren't any specialist carp papers. Any of the monthly magazines I couldn't really afford. I used to perhaps buy one or two of the, say, June and July summer issues. So there was very little information, your local tackle shop or other club members. So literally what we did, and this is 100% true, in fact, you mentioned good old Frank Warwick, who's a pal of mine. His latest book, I think, is called Every Bit of Blue.
Yeah.
And that strikes at my heart, because the way in which I found several waters to fish, probably a half a dozen different waters, from private syndicate waters to club lakes, was to get an ordnance survey map of 1 inch to the mile, within an hour's drive of North London, of which there were hundreds of lakes, because obviously I live near the Lee Valley. So there were hundreds of lakes to go to, but also that gave me a remit to go and look at Cambridgeshire area, where I did a lot of fishing. And you'd have a look at the bits of blue, perhaps go and call in at the local farmhouse or the local house that was on it, and perhaps, you know, hello, hope you don't mind me calling, but I'm wondering if you allow fishing at the lake. And it was literally like that. Or perhaps if there was a sign up on these lakes and you liked the look of them, you'd go and ask the members there, or wait outside the gate for a member to come through and say, "Oh, excuse me, mate, you know, if you don't mind me asking, has this water got any carp in it?" And then you had to assume they were telling the truth, because most people wanted to keep it to themselves. And that is literally how I found out about carp, you know, well, all sorts of different venues, you know, tench, carp, pipe.
Yeah, basically doing the legwork.
Doing the legwork, yeah.
You mentioned people don't want to tell you about carp. I was recently in the boatyard, the fly fishing shop at the side of Rutland Water.
Oh, right.
I asked them if there was any carp in there, which, you know, it gets its water from the Nene and the Welland, of course there is. And the fella behind me, he says, "No, there's no carp in here." I gave him the stare. He just kind of looked away and started pottering around somewhere, which told me, "There's big carp in here."
Yeah, of course there is.
Usually you can tell, even when they're lying, just straight to your face, you just...
Well, they don't look... People that are telling you fibs don't... apparently, they don't look straight in your eyes. Yeah. Apparently, that's an interview an interrogation technique or something, you know.
Yeah, I think Jeremy Paxman does it with his politicians, and I love the way he grills. I'm not going to do that here, don't worry.
I'm glad about that.
Well, no, you did find some quite well-known waters. There's one I love reading about in certain books. Very small and intimate. Ashley Pool.
Well, Ashley Pool, I found. But that was actually through my early association with the Carp Anglers Association and the BCSG, the British Carp Study Group, because Ashley Pool, at the time that I started to get keen on maybe fishing it, started to be run by a good pal of mine, who sadly now passed away, but a great guy who founded the CAA and BCSG, Peter Moen. Prior to that, it was a completely closed shop, but the pool itself changed hands, and a lovely veterinary surgeon, retired veterinary surgeon, bought it, and he didn't mind people fishing basically in what was his garden. It was so exclusive, and I felt I was properly carp fishing. I liked small venues, small lakes, small intimate waters, you know, where you're fishing for the carp, not against other anglers. And I think the essence of carp fishing is having the opportunity and the chance, when you can, to just pit your wits against the fish, to not have that diminished, spoilt, or upset by outside influences and other people, you know, because the whole fun of carp fishing, or most of the fun of carp fishing, is in the preparation.
Yeah, it's like you're on a mission, it's like you're on a hunt, you know, you're doing your, well, nowadays for me anyway, it's, you know, checking the weather. You know, I love a lot of technology that we've got now. You know, I can get my phone out, I can look at a lake on Google Maps, I know exactly which way north is, you know, and which way the southwesterlies are going to blow, and yeah, you can see the features. It's all a lot different now, but, you know, it's about preparation. What sort of things was it back then, obviously, without the technology? Just getting the tackle ready, the baits ready, the research, seeing what's happened before, what was in there, or was it all...
Well, a lot of these waters, we didn't know what was in there. What actually happened was, I mean, you sort of going back to Ashley Pool, or going back to any of these small and intimate waters, we did start to pick up a lot more information on the press about, you know, waters having carp in them that were perhaps our next target, because, believe it or not, at the time, I was catching maybe 50 or 60 carp a year, and catching those fish, I was keen. I was going once midweek and possibly the whole weekend, living at home with my parents, so I had the time to put in. But these fish were doubles, you know. You'd go away and you'd have a great weekend catching 11 and 12 pounders. You know, the 20 pounders just weren't there. There weren't the waters that contained 20 pounders. What's happened in the last 40 or 50 years with all our lovely gravel pits and the good strains of fish that we brought into the UK, or grown on, or learned how to grow on in the stock ponds and the fish farms, you know, they're now making 50 and 60 pounds in some waters, you know, which is unheard of. I mean, it's beyond your wildest dreams to think that in the 1960s and 70s there would ever be 50 and 60 pound carp and lots of them to go at. So 20 pounds was the target, and the preparation for catching these fish, for me, was all about bait. The bait bug, for me, I caught it very, very early. And so I made it difficult for myself by taking too many different things with me. So, yeah, my preparation was twofold. I used to like going to waters where I had free access, so they didn't mind if perhaps the landowner would let me use the lake owner would let me use a boat. And I specifically targeted places where they were owned by farmers or private individuals, you know, not necessarily club waters, because I like to do a lot of fishing, just two or three of us, targeting the water. So we'd all decide to use chickpeas, or we'd all decide to use maple peas, or, you know, this was before boilies came on the scene. We were using special paste, which was pet foods, cat foods, that sort of thing. But it was long before the sort of broader technology came in, and we didn't need to worry about that, because a sack of dried maize or a sack of dried maple peas or chickpeas, you know, could be picked up for 10 quid and it'd last you all season.
Yeah.
But it's the preparation. You know, for example, you know, there were no wraps. You didn't have wraps. You know, I was fishing on the bar, it's 8.5 wraps, you know, there's none of that. So what we used to do is we used to take the boat out and tie a small piece of brick to the bottom of a Norfolk reed, drop it over the side of the boat so the top of the Norfolk reed poked out, and then you just cast next to the Norfolk reed, and that was a marker. Yeah, I remember doing that specifically where I was fishing with three rods on one lake, and there'd be three Norfolk reeds all at different angles all around the lake. And the interesting thing about some of these waters is you've got the opportunity to quietly observe the fish and how they behaved over beds of bait and over individual baits. And because they weren't heavily fished for, you'd quickly get a result from your baiting strategy and your preparation. Whereas now, you know, fishing busy waters, fishing club waters and busy syndicate waters, it's difficult to put bait in and go back and check your baited areas, because the chances are somebody else has seen the fish moving in your, all the effort you've put in and the work you've put in, and you then can't get the swim.
Yeah, a lot of things have changed. But even going back to your account that unpressured, like any wild creature, they can be trained with food. You know, an analogy that Jamie put to me a while back, you know, with winter fishing, if you're the only one throwing the bread in your garden, that's where all the sparrows are going to be.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I've started to write about this, hopefully in my book when it ever eventually gets completed. But one of the chapters in the book, which I've never really spoken about before, and you've just now inspired me to say something, it's called what I call the bird table effect. Yeah. And the bird table effect, a pal of mine about 5 years ago rang me up and he said, have you got any green finches in your garden? So I said to him, no, not at the moment, because I haven't put any food out for them. And he said, well, what sort of food's that? So I said, well, this time of year, which was early in the year, April time, the green finches seem to like the small Niger seeds, little black Niger seeds, so they've got quite high in protein, and that it seems to suit them. So I said to him, if you put Niger seeds out, I bet you get green finches. So I said, I'll tell you what, go and buy some Niger seeds and put them on your bird table and ring me up when the green finches come. Yeah. 2 days later, he phoned me up and he said, I can't believe it. Within 48 hours of putting Niger seeds on my bird table, I had green finches. He said, how did they know they were there? So I said, well, they knew you had a bird table there. Just like carp are aware of clear areas on the lake bed. And human interaction with birds is just the same as human interaction with carp. Birds eat food that we put out on bird tables, but they also eat natural food. When there's a lot of natural food, they won't come to the bird table. When they need certain vitamins that they can't get, certain minerals or proteins that they can't get through their natural diet, they'll come to the bird table, providing we put the right food on the bird table for them. With carp, we do exactly the same thing. Human interaction, we give them food, you put it in the right place, and you give them the type and quality and nutrition in a bait that they want to eat and that their body is genetically telling them that is good for them. And I will specifically say that they are able to genetically recognise better nutritious food, and they get better at doing that the older they get. Unlike humans, whose senses diminish with age, a carp's senses gets better. So when you talk about, I can't quite remember the thread of where this I've gone off. It's because you mentioned about,
yeah,
the birds. So yes, the observation from years ago is really no different than it is now, except it's just different now than it was before, because we all know so much more about bait, nutrition, presentation, and the fish are a lot more discerning because they have more choice.
Yeah, they certainly do have more choice, especially on a lot of these busy waters. They're getting all sorts thrown at them, from particles, sweet corn, and a multitude of different boilers, of different flavours, and, you know, fishy, sweet, fruity. So, where was it when you mentioned boiler? Well, let's get back to then. When was the first time you heard about a boiler preparation, and, you know, you've moved from the maples and chickpeas, that sort of thing, and...
Yes, I do remember. I mean, it was again through the British Carp Study Group magazine. I was not a member of the British Carp Study Group in 1973-74. And some articles were published in that magazine, which was the only real specialist carp magazine available. You had to be a member to get it. But obviously I knew some pals. That same pal who helped me out, a guy called Len, and he let me read his copies of the magazine. Good mates of his, and I read an article in there, several articles about making boilers. You know, the paste that I was using was being eaten by small fish, and here was what people writing about using boilers, which was paste that had been boiled, and that was simply to stop nuisance fish or unwanted fish eating it. So that I started boiling my paste. With disastrous results, because the ingredients weren't right. But I soon found out what those ingredients were. And then I vividly remember somebody at my local club lake. I quietly was wandering along the bank, good bankside activity and behaviour, being nice and quiet. And as I stumbled into his swim, he was on the point of casting out. He was casting out this perfectly round ball of red or pink coloured bait, and it was a boilie. And I can't remember the exact words between us, other than the fact that he said to me, "Oh, you've caught me using a boilie." So I said, "Well, I haven't caught you, I wasn't trying to catch you." And he said, "Anyway," he said, "you'll never find out what's in this bait." And I was absolutely incensed by this, and I looked at him, he was a pal of mine, and I said, "That's the best thing you could have ever said to me." And he looked at me as if I was mad, and I said, "Because not only will I find out what's in that bait, but I will have the ingredients within the next few months." And he said, "Oh yeah, we'll see," or whatever he said. I don't think it was quite those words. But sure enough, I went and did the research, and I was making my own specialist high nutrient value boilies within 3 months of seeing that. I was like a red rag with a bull.
Yeah.
And a red rag to a bull with a bull. Anyway, whatever that bull thing is, I was mad keen.
What were the first results fish-wise on your early baits? Were they catching, or was it...
Well, mixed, yeah. Because I had no idea of flavour levels, the content of the bait. I mean, I actually went back to using ground up pet food, dried cat food, ground up in a food processor, mixing it with eggs, because the first time I tried to add concentrated flavours together and put them in a base mix, powder mix, I obviously put far too much flavour in, which I think at the time I was using pear essence mixed with vanilla. Because my mother had used vanilla to make Victoria sponge cake, but it was there in the cupboard. There wasn't anywhere you could buy flavours, so you used what was in the kitchen. And I blanked because the bait was acting as a repellent; it was just too strong. So I went back to more natural ingredients, and it was only when I started to share ideas with others, who I trusted. And then we realised
you know, that, that carp had such incredibly delicate senses of smell. And we started to measure our additives much more carefully.
Yeah. There was a few of yous, you know, all following the same lines then, all...
Yeah, it was... It had become a an obsession with quite a few people by then, because, you know, we all want the ultimate bait, don't we?
Oh, we still do.
We still do.
We're waiting as well.
I mean, it's the angler's El Dorado, isn't it? You know,
it is, yeah.
I've got this ingredient and it costs £1,000. I've got this ingredient and it comes from, you know, a Tibetan monk who synthesizes it over 3 years.
He gets his toenail shavings.
Yeah. I think there was a Monty Python sketch or something, isn't it? You know, where they use those ridiculous voices, yeah. Oh, what'd you get that? You know, powdered lark's vomit, you know? Emulsified sparrow's bile, you know? Yes, it was all around the time of Monty Python, so we did... I can remember we used to have some great fun winding people up about what we were using. Good. And we used
and
to actually... Took
it serious,
well, you've just reminded me of something, because one thing we did do is we used to take the real bait that we were catching the fish on, and then another bait with some horrible colour in it, or ridiculous smell, or no smell at all, and leave a few boilers... Just thrown away in the, you know, like as if you'd spilt them out of the pouch of the catapult. You just used to leave them, so that you knew people were going to come into your swim, because we were catching loads of fish, and people, you know, come and swim and search about in the amongst the dockweeds and the rushes. Yeah, yeah.
Find one of your decoys.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Yeah,
yeah. It's a happy one for throwing the odd decoy myself, but that's usually you know, baiting up a corner when I know I'm being watched with a few pouchfuls of pea gravel. People go,
that's a good one.
That's one of the off of a mate of mine. He's I know he's baiting someone on the motorway pond and putting the weed back when he's finished.
It's funny you used to say baiting up with gravel, you know, making out you're using particles or something, but actually using boilers. I can remember going to one particular park lake near me and walking around. I didn't used to fish there, but there was a few small fish in there, and there was a young lad fishing away with his mum. It was great. And I said to him, "Hello, have you done any good? Have you caught anything?" And he said, "No, not yet." But he said, "I'm going to get one in a minute, because one jumped out by my float." I said, "Oh, great. It must be there then." He said, "Yeah." And then he picked up a stone, a small stone, about the size of your fingernail, from next to him, and threw it next to his float. So I said, "Why'd you throw that stone?" And he said, "The perch think it's ground bait." What's the logic in that?
Oh, no, they don't.
They don't think it's ground bait, but bless his heart, that was what he said. Oh, dear. I've never forgotten that.
Yeah, I've seen people do similar sort of stuff with molehill muck. One of the theory behind that is well, worm stuffing.
Yeah, in fact...
Attracting spits out.
I read a book by the famous match angler, Benny Ashurst. And... in fact, we've got a lot to learn from match anglers, because they've done a lot, haven't we? Yeah, well, you used to do a bit of match fishing, so.
Yeah, and I've mentioned on the podcast before, there's a fella, Andy, who used to live next door, so he's a real good match angler. Yeah, we both go out to cut his lawns, and the lawns never get cut, we just talk crap over the fence for an hour and get nothing.
But no, the. Certainly, the match angler, Benny Hasho's book, he wrote about using. Loam, you know, which is like molehill stuff, is a really high quality sort of leaf mould and loam, and actually making ground bait in it, just by nothing else, just moistening this loam with lake water and chucking it in, and it was exciting the fish into feeding, but without feeding them.
Yeah, there's no real food items in there to fill up on the
But it was attracting them. Certainly the French match anglers have always been, you know, way ahead of us. I remember 30-odd years ago speaking to Palomine, who could speak French, and he lived in France. And we started to... he was involved with me in Bait 78 days, when I was involved in Bait 78, which was one of the first ever bait companies in the UK, which I started. And
we had the agency in the UK for Sensas ground baits.
Yeah.
And this guy made Sensas ground baits. I've only just remembered that. Yeah. And
still going.
Still going. Sensas, massive, massive. They own Star Baits in France. And the French started toasting peanuts, which increases their calorific value, but it also stabilises them. And we were grinding up fresh peanuts, not roasted peanuts, to put in our bait. But that's not a good thing to do, because it oxidises the bait, and the bait goes off within 24 hours. But if you toast the peanut meal, which you can do on your own, you know, just grind it up, toast it under the grill, now you can buy toasted peanut meal, which is, you know, a great product used in some base mixes. But this guy was telling me about all the complex things that the French match anglers were doing to make their own ground bait. And some of these guys went on to be consultants for Van den Eynde and Sensas. And they're clever guys, and you can still learn from these match anglers.
Oh, without a doubt. And there's, you know, working in a tackle shop, you know, you speak to the match anglers, some of the methods as well, because they're fishing for these, you know, commercial carp, and for me, a carp's a carp, and some of these commercial carp, they're more pressured than the ones we fish for in some cases. They're getting match fished by very good anglers, you know, some of them day in, day out. And there's a fellow I was talking to a while back, he's fishing his little, you know, flat method feeder.
Yeah.
But it's the bog standard way to fish it is, well, you buy a 4-inch hook link. You know, so just a short one to put your hook bait near your little pile of ground bait or pallets, whatever you've got on it. He was fishing an 18-inch hook link and winning. You know, a lot of the carp, they're sussed out, well, I'm not going to eat that pile. It's danger. I'll eat away from it. And they get caught.
That is, I'd never heard that before, but that is very similar to a lot of carp fisheries in the UK, and in particular in France, where they allow bait boats.
Yeah.
Where people are relying so heavily on the baiting pattern and the presentation that they get from opening the remote control bait doors and dropping their hook bait in amongst a load of pellets or particles, borders, call it what you will. And I've fished in France regularly, sometimes two or three times a year for the last 25 years. And in the last 10 to 15 years, on waters that are used where bait boats are allowed, they're my favourite, because I've never used a bait boat. And I use the scattered approach of fishing with boilers. It's a devastating effect. You know, remarkable results in a very short time with very little bait. And that must be similar to what you just said about the carp learning to not go near a tightly packed feeder, but they will feed 18 inches.
Pick up the, you know, it's a little, basically it's tiny boilers that they're using, you know, or, you know, pellets that they've banded on. But we mentioned the, you know, the bait boat thing. Motorway pond up in East Yorkshire. You know, back in the motorway madness days, where they call themselves, and the good head of theatres in there, there was, you know, I think it was Yorkshire's second or third 40 in there, but, you know, the biggest fish in the county for quite some years.
It came under a bit of attention then.
A lot of attention, and a lot of bait boats. It was, you know, just what was done on there. A friend of mine went on there, and exactly as you've described, you know, they laughed at him as he's got his catapult and he's spraying baits everywhere. He was taking the piss. He's got his bolt in and he's like putting him out on his spot, but laughing at him. So he's like turning his back to the lake and pouching him up in the air.
Yeah.
And, I know, you know the next.
Yeah.
He spanked him.
Yeah, I bet he did. And I bet he caught a lot of the bigger fish.
Yeah, he did. All apart from the one he really wanted, one called Nelson.
Oh, right.
Still took the piss out of him.
Why do so many lakes have carp in them called Nelson, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Nelson or the parrot or, you know.
Oh, there's Nelson's, parrots, scalies.
Scalies, you know,
big cones.
Big scale, little tail, crinkle tail.
Oh, yeah. I seen on Twitter the day, Mike Kavanagh made a post of a fish. It's the best name I've seen. And its eye was kind of like facing backwards. It was known as the rear view mirror.
That's brilliant.
That made me chuckle. I didn't enjoy that one.
The rear view mirror. Well, talking about names of fish, one of the lakes I fished earlier in my early 20s, it was great then. And there was this one fish, and it had one petrel fin. And we used to always say, well, you know when you've caught that, because it always swims to the left. And so it ended up with the name, the One Fin Wonder.
Yeah, I know there's, you get some weird, some just boring names, to be fair. Personally, I prefer fish who are just named after a description. Yeah. You know, like, you know, the Long Mirror, or, you know, the Big Comet. It's pretty bland, but when I was on Pit 1 at Elstow, oh, God, Captain Crudwick. The Slag, because everyone's had a...
The Slag.
And I caught that one. You know, we had the Dark Cloud, which I believe is still around today.
That's a nice name, the Dark Cloud.
But I was thinking it's Dark Cloud, because it is, you know, quite a leathery, real, like, you know, grey fish. Now, apparently, the first person to catch it over 30 was a fellow who was always miserable. And he was named the Dark Cloud, so the fish got his name. The Unattended was a good one.
The Unattended?
Yeah, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
That was, and I believe it was Frank Warwick's first UK 40 as well.
Is that right?
Yeah, I could be wrong, but that's a thing me and Frank have in common. But we're going off on a bit of a tangent here. I want to get back to yourself. And you mentioned Bait 78. You know, you started a bait company while I was in nursery.
Well, I was approached I was making bait either in my friend's kitchen or my own kitchen, driving my mother crazy, making stuff using the food processors and all sorts of other things. Even around that time, I'd even managed to get, and this is completely true because it cropped up in conversation about half an hour before we started this tape,
yeah.
I'd even managed to obtain some incredible flavour from a specialist company, and I got that flavour by ordering it through Boots the Chemist. I actually went and asked if they could supply me from this company, which is a company in Walthamstow, East London, and they rang me back a week later and said, yeah, we can get that flavour for you. And that flavour was the original salmon flavour.
Oh, it's not where you'd think to go for a flavour.
No, that's Boots. Completely true. Boots the Chemist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
so that extra mile.
Yeah, so all around that time where I was so keen it hurt. I mean, I was really, really enthusiastic, keen, still living at home with mum and dad, you know, plenty of free time. And I was making bait for other anglers, and eventually, you know, people were absolutely catching loads of fish. And so this businessman approached me and said, I'm going to start a bait company. Can you help me and advise me? And, you know, I thought, oh, you know, make a bit of extra money and all the rest of it. You know, little did I know there's really not a great deal of money in the bait game unless you do it, you know, on a fairly major scale. And we didn't really know what we were doing. This chap had a big plumbing and heating company.
I suppose back then carp fishing was still quite a small niche, not like it is today.
No, it was very small niche. I mean, we couldn't generate enough volume sales to make any proper return, and they even opened up a small tackle shop and were selling the bait in the tackle shop. But by then, a number of other people were selling it from home. And it's much like the evolution of what's happened with the rolled bait and boilie industry today, where a lot of it's based on cottage industry, people making bait at home.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's taken away a lot of the retail profit market from people stocking it in shops. But anyway, I'm digressing.
Yeah.
Going back to Bait 78 days, that was fantastic because, you know, I had access to trade ingredients then, so I could make my bait cheaper, which was one of the motivating factors. But in actual fact, after only about a year and a half, I resigned from the company because I was so keen on my fishing, and I'd come up against so much stick and criticism from other people about, you know, giving away secrets and trying to make money out of fishing. Can you believe that? When there's about 300 bait companies in England now, but then we were the only bait company. I think there were two bait companies. It was us and maybe Jeff Kemp had just started.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd sit on the bank side, you know, and people knew I was involved in commercial baits, and people wouldn't talk to me. It was crazy. So I came out of it and went trout fishing for a few years. Yeah, I was very disillusioned with it then, actually. I still kept my enthusiasm for it. I'm, you know, still very interested in it all, and did it all for myself and a couple of close friends. And people relied on me very heavily which I loved, you know. I mean, that pandered to my ego. Of course it did. But I didn't come back into it then after the boat 78 days until 1990. When,
quite a gap.
Yeah, 12-year gap. I came back into it then, and then I got into barbel fishing and started to develop barbel baits, which was unbelievable. Unbelievable. But I'd never been fished for before with boilers, and it was...
hemp and luncheon meat.
Yeah. Rivers that had seen hemp, luncheon meat, tares, maggots, casters, you know, luncheon meat coated in spices and that sort of thing. And you give them boilers, which were, you know, roach proof, chublet proof, small fish proof, sank to the bottom, stayed in the on the riverbed for 12 hours, waiting for the barbel to come and eat them. I mean, when I first tested the baits for barbel on my local river, I had 18 barbel in one evening, literally. And I didn't go back for a good week because I felt that I was almost cheating.
Yeah.
You know, it was that easy. You know, the hair rig as well, that made a massive difference.
Of course, that was around that time. That was a big game changer.
Well, I mean, it was a game changer in the early 80s because a lot of people caught fish using basic baits, spoilers, because of the hair rig, but not because of the bait.
Yeah, because I can't suck something in to try it because it's, like old reduction said, they've not got hands, so they suck it in.
Yeah.
It's pretty straight back out.
That time, I mean, he's quite right, but that time was pivotal, and it was a game changer for an awful lot of people. I can remember fishing next to a couple of very well-known anglers, indeed high-profile anglers, I won't say who they are, and they were using the hair rig and I wasn't, because they wouldn't tell me, and I was out fishing them, believe it or not, purely on adrenaline, enthusiasm and tenacity and bait. And that weekend I stopped getting bites. They caught some fish and I wasn't getting bites, and one of them came into my swim and said, "You've got fish in your swim but you can't catch them. I can do something to your rig which will transfer those twitch bites you're getting into a full blown run." And I said, "No, thanks." I said, I'll guess it myself. I'll guess what you're doing myself before I let you do that. And I said, "But I won't be inviting you ever again to my syndicate, Walter, because you should be telling me what you're doing if you're a real mate." I'll never forget that. And he said, "Oh, we've made a promise, you know, we wouldn't say anything." And then when I did find out what the hair rig was, which actually I ended up working it out for myself, because I realised the bait wasn't attached to the hook, so it must be tied on, and eventually I guessed it and they told me. Yeah. But that was several months later. So when I started using the hair rig, literally we were using 26 inch hook links and 2¾ inch long hairs.
That's long.
That's long.
I like long hair, obviously, but...
Yeah, I can tell.
Yeah,
so the hair rigs that people use now, they're not really hair rigs. They're just self-hooking rigs.
Yeah. You know, I've been to myself, went through a phase. This is going back a long time. I was playing around with, like, length of hairs, and honestly, it's not something I've done for a long while, and I don't know why. But I've got my little two rigs that I'm happy they work. I just don't need a change. I've got confidence in them, and I'm not as kind of experimenting as I used to be.
Well, I think time is precious, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we all, definitely. You know, some of us have the opportunity and enthusiasm to fish more than others, but once you've got two or three tactics, rigs, terminal setups that work, why on earth change it? I mean, a friend of mine, Dennis, he says that a hair rig is a hair rig is a hair rig, and they all work pretty much the same way. And the most important thing about the rig is, how is it presenting itself on the bottom, and will it tangle up, and does it tangle up? And if it doesn't tangle up, when it does present itself on the bottom, then the key and critical thing, in my view, is the original principle of the hair rig, which is not the length of the hair necessarily, but it's the length of the hair in relation to the size of the hook link. I think the length of the hook link and the size of the hair and the size of the bait and the size of the hook is really, really important. And we always used to use a boilie that was only about 10% greater diameter than the overall diameter of the, or width of the gape of the hook. So that, so that if they just opened their mouths to take in the boilie, they didn't have to, the hook wasn't bigger than the boilie, so that the hook would follow in. So we used to tend to use smaller hooks than people do now. And I think there's a trend now to using smaller hooks, you know, using plastic corn and that fishing over spod, spod mix.
Yeah.
So, you know, very, with the hook technology now, they're very, you can use a very, very strong small hook.
Yeah, I've got some, size 10s that I use occasionally if I'm using a small plastic hook bait, and now they're so strong and so sharp as well. It's, I can't imagine what you used to become. I remember when I first started fishing, I'd always test the sharpness of my hooks, but instead of changing it, I'd just think, well, that rod's got the blunt hook on, I'll strike hard.
Unlike what we used to do, you say strike hard, I mean, if you didn't strike the bites, you didn't catch anything. But I can remember once taking, before using ledgers, because I used to think ledgering was cheating, and I took a flask with frozen bait, the hook buried in paste that was frozen, took it out of the flask and cast it into the lake on the basis that the bait was bound to defrost before I got a bite, and then of course getting a bite before it had defrosted and finding it completely impossible to strike the hook through the frozen bait. I can remember doing that.
Yeah. Now there's one thing I was going to bring up with you. Earlier on this year, I had a guest night with Dave Moore on his lake up in North Yorkshire.
Okay, yeah.
And you come up in conversation, first thing he said was plum flavour. You know, you've been associated with, with plum flavour and, some others for quite a while. I know we've chatted before this, you've got quite a few things to say about flavours and, the makeup and the effectiveness as well. How there's a lot of misunderstanding about flavours that can actually work, how there can be, umpteen different strawberry flavours. Most of them are useless for fishing.
Well, yes, we did have that conversation. And, look, I'm not a chemist, but where I've learnt about which flavours work better than others is by going fishing. And that is the best test. And with the internet now, you can search for flavours and additives on the internet and find 50 companies in the UK that will provide you with a trade purchase of, let's say, for example, strawberry flavour, cream flavour, fishy flavours, whatever you like. They'll even maybe make you a flavour that matches your requirements. But what goes into that flavour and how it's made is vitally important. And all I've been able to do is, by a process of elimination over the few years, is find out the common denominators and the key ingredients that work better than others. For example, I've got a book at home which actually lists recipes for flavours, and it's dated about 1948-49. So it's a really old technology book. And one of the flavours in there was a plum flavour.
Yeah.
I read this book about 25 years ago. And this plum flavour has got a column going across the top, plum flavour version 1 to 7. And going down the side is all the ingredients that go into 7 different plum flavours. But by the time you get to plum flavour, for example, number 1, it's got 6 out of 25 ingredients in it. So there's 25 ingredients down the left-hand side. These are called esters and flavour compounds. By the time you get to the last version of the plum flavour, it's only got one of the original 7 ingredients in it, but 11 of the other. So if you've got a code number as an angler from a flavour company, you know, in some big town where they've been making flavours in this company for 100 years, whatever it is, doesn't matter what it is, and you say, oh, can I have flavour number 1234B, that might be a flavour that is made for, say, children's medicines, or made for going into chocolates, fondant centres, or hard candy.
I like fondant.
Yeah, and so that can stand boiling.
Yeah.
But you might choose another flavour from the same company, and some companies, for example, one of the ones I use, they make over 400 different strawberry flavours.
Wow.
Yeah. And then you end up with a strawberry flavour that's, say, made to go into yogurts and soft drinks, which completely boils out when you put it in a boiling recipe. So, you know, over the years, you establish which flavours work better, which ones won't boil out, which ones stay in the mix, and also the ingredients that go into them that work. Now, specifically, you've got me on my hobby horse here now.
Yeah, no.
You specifically, you mentioned strawberries.
Yeah.
This is completely true and accurate, but there are over 300 different identifiable aroma compounds and esters in strawberries. 300. In plum,
there
are probably, I don't know, I haven't counted them and I haven't looked it up, but there's probably a couple of hundred. Going back to my plum flavour, I found a company who were making flavours under the new technology that faithfully matched the original fruit. So they were expensive because they were using real aroma compounds. So it transpires that the plum flavour I was using was made probably at some point for somebody like Cadbury's, you know, a top company. Obviously, they wouldn't provide me with exactly the same recipe, but they tweaked it. And my plum flavour's got 37 ingredients in it. Now, you can say, well, does that make it any better? Well, results speak for themselves. You only need 1 mil of it in 6 eggs, and I'm now down to 0.75 of a mil to 6 eggs. I'm using less and less and less of it when I use it. It's just a lucky recipe, which I happen to have stumbled across, and I'm pleased to say that 2 years ago I bought the worldwide rights to it, because it's so brilliant that I had to own it. And it cost me a lot of money, but I now own that flavour completely, as well as a few others that I've developed. But there's common denominators in flavours. They're not magic ingredients, but when you use them in combination, they seem to work better than when you use them individually. You know, for example, butyric acid.
Yeah. That's a single man smell, that one.
It is, but funnily enough, butyric acid is often used in flavours which are non-savoury. It's a savoury type flavour. It's an organic acid. And then there's other organic acids. There's about 6 that get used regularly in savoury flavours. But, you know, it isn't butyric on its own, which is good. But when you start mixing it with something else, a catalyst, it acts like a catalyst. A reaction takes place, and again, I'm not a chemist, but all I can tell you is the profile and the strength and the characteristic of that flavour gives the end product a complexity which the carp pick up. And I mentioned earlier on about carp senses improving as they get older.
Yeah, that's something I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah.
Because ours go the other way around.
Well, human beings, you know, you might go a bit deaf when you're older, and you might, you know, need reading glasses by the time you're 45 and all that sort of thing. I certainly do. I've got glasses everywhere in my house. Glasses in the car, glasses in the garage.
My wife might have said the best thing about glasses. She says, there was nothing wrong with my eyes till I went to the optician.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I've lost the thread of what...
Yeah, about the carp and the senses increasing as they...
Senses increasing, yeah. Where this first cropped up was when I started, you know, going off and fishing, if you like, off-piste, as you would call it in skiing terms. So you go to a water that you've never fished before. You think, well, you know, what the hell am I going to do here? You know, I've got a guest ticket, or, you know, I'm back in the 90s, and I'm perhaps doing a magazine article or something like that. So you'd go to a water you just had to sort of fish on instinct. So you take your best bait, and sometimes you'd end up within the first 24 hours catching the biggest fish in the lake. This is what was happening to me, and I was thinking, well, why am I catching one of the biggest fish in the lake? You know, people say, oh, you're lucky, you know, you've caught that big one that doesn't very often come out. And it transpired that by not compromising on the base ingredients, particularly the base mix ingredients, and by using the right levels of flavour, I was using bait that didn't require any pre-baiting, because the nature of the mix, the profile of the flavour, and how that complemented it, the whole complete overall bait, was instantly attractive to fish. So no pre-baiting was required. And you think, well, why were the big ones eating it? And the big ones are eating it because they've been around longer, and they found that by genetic recognition, this is what I've called it, the big fish were older. Mostly an old fish has got big because it's clever. It's also genetically able to put on more weight than others, so it's, you know, going to be targeted, it's going to be in a water that's, you know, it's fished for, etc, etc.
Attract the bounty hunters.
Yeah, attracts all the bounty hunters, etc. But, you know, there's it's not coincidental, because it happens with barbel as well, and barbel are omnivores as well. You know, you use a really good bait on a heavily fished, it works best on the most heavily fished waters. You use a very good bait, obviously you've got to put it in the right place, you know, all the usual watercraft and tactics. And funnily enough, you know, the first fish you often catch is the biggest one in the lake. And it keeps happening time and time and time again. And all the common denominators start to come together. And you think, well, you know, I mentioned the bird table effect. You know, you can be at a lake you've never fished before, and through experience you can put your bait in the right spot, you're there for a couple of days, you're creating a new bird table. And what happens is that the small fish probably home in on that little short-term bird table first, but they go away and tell their mates. And this is what happens with birds, what happens with wild animals. They can communicate with people. Carp aren't quite people, but they can communicate with their own species quicker and easier than we will ever know.
Yeah, that is something I don't think we could ever understand, but it's without some of the things I have seen in watching fish, they communicate. Like, so I've watched, yeah, when I've baited margin spots, particularly on Elstow 2, because it was deep margins and gin clear water, it was perfect for watching. You know, I've seen, you know, a couple of fish come in. You know, two that spring to mind were Uncle Scaly, one called Epaulette. Quite a distinctive fish. Almost always, 9 times out of 10, you saw one, the other was not far behind, it was there. But there's one time, I've got a feeling on this one spot. 2 days later, I mean, I put quite a lot of bait in there. Every fish in the lake is turning that lake to milk. They've absolutely destroyed that spot. And then I lost one and spooked them. But anyway,
no, I mean it's look, it's a never-ending subject, and you know we're
it's fascinating though.
It is absolutely fascinating, and listen, you know, I suppose my enthusiasm for all this is something that people might wonder about, because you know I've particularly in the last 10 to 15 years. I certainly do not rely on any form of commercially selling bait, if you like. I've got a small website, and you know, my products are quite expensive, etc, etc. So I'm not really interested in earning a living from selling bait, and that, I suppose, that makes me quite unique. But I can't stop being enthusiastic about it. I'm constantly researching and looking at stuff all the time, because I'm building on what I already know. And you know, the ultimate bait thing that we spoke about earlier on. And
it's refreshing to hear passion before profit in today.
Well, it's true. It is honestly true. You know, I would rather see somebody, you know, that is telling me or communicating to me how enthusiastic they are, and I will write to them, I will send them an email, and I will help them because I love that enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And, you know, the bounty hunter type thing, you know, we'll tick off another 40 from that lake and tick off another 40 from that lake. I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in is the people that want to learn, that want to truly understand more about their fishing, rather than just saying, well, I know this works, I know that works, I'm going to put that rig in that place and join that club and sit in the lake every week until I catch that, and then I move on to the next thing. That's not really fishing. I'm not knocking those people that actually do it. It's just that I don't want to do that myself. But what motivates me is the true enthusiasm of and the passion that comes through from people who want to learn more and want to understand more about why something works. And a lot of people, I think, in angling should ask themselves the question, well, why does that work? And I think if you can ask yourself why it works, you get to understand how to do whatever that is, perhaps better.
Yeah, or even replicate it, because there's a lot of people I see from the tackle shop, yeah, they might buy a load of gear, go out, catch a 20. Yeah, they're chuffed, you know, well done, fair play to them, but then they struggle and don't know why. There's so many variables, and it's that kept me going on in my car for my love, but I fish for everything, you know, especially perch and chub when I get the chance. It's
well, we were talking about zig rigs earlier on. It's not something I do a lot of, zig fishing, because I'm a bit of a dyed in the wool, you know, bottom bait boilie guy, but I've caught plenty of fish doing it the other way round. And in fact, this year, I've caught quite a few, quite a few fish float fishing with just a float, no shot, a piece of paste with the bait moulded around the hook, no hair rig, and the carp are cruising about under the surface, and you're holding the rod all the time, and they come under the float, suck the paste in, and give you a roach bite, and it's a 20-pounder, and you strike.
And then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, so you're using a zig-type rig, but it's not, because it's under a float. And the float's just drifting about randomly on the surface. And in weed, that tactic is deadly, because you can't get tangled up, because the hook is buried in the paste.
And I don't know when a member of my syndicate to listen to this, because it's just giving away something.
Oh, is it? Oh, sorry about that. But that is a deadly tactic.
Yeah.
You know, couldn't be more simple, could it?
No, not at all. In fact, hour and 5 minutes already. That's flown by, but I'll tell you one method that is doing really, really well on some of the deeper commercial carp fisheries up near me, your match fisheries, is one. They've actually nicknamed it the Numpty, because it's so effective, anyone could catch it. It's fishing with a slow sinking bubble.
A slow sinking bubble?
Yeah, it's literally. It's like some homemade things that we get in the shop that we buy from a fella. Some at £3 each.
Yeah.
This isn't a plug for the shop, by the way. But, and just imagine a ledger bomb that has as near to neutral buoyancy as you can get.
Right.
And that's what this is. Then with a pellet, you know, on your hook link, they just cast it out and just watch the tip and wait for it to be dragged round.
Really?
And it is, you know, a couple of waters, you know, the deeper ones, it has to be said, they're getting absolutely destroyed by it. I know some match venues have even banned it because it is just too good.
Well, that is quite interesting, because
it's mid-water off the bottom.
Mid-water off the bottom. Even if you catapult floating pellets or sinking pellets in, if you're using pellets, I know the match anglers do this a lot. They're aiming to get the fish to come up in the water.
Yeah.
But if you can. Dickie Carr, the famous match angler.
I remember watching the videos years back.
Yeah, well, I can remember. I designed his ground bait additives for him, actually.
Yeah.
Here, Carr and Borley ground baits, yeah, back in the 80s. Anyway, he shot a book with him called Success with the Pole. and I did all the photography for it. And I used to do a bit of photography professionally. And I said to him, what's the most important thing to you about winning matches? What tactic do you strive for over and above anything else? And he said, if you, in his lovely voice, if you can get the hook bait to behave exactly like the free offerings, you'll catch more fish. Sorry, Dickie, that's a very bad takeoff of your accent, but he's got a great accent,
exactly,
Dickie.
What this slow sinking bubble tries to mimic.
And you know what? That's what a lot of people are trying to do now, and some people have got it spot on. Yeah. In fact, I know some anglers who get their baits to, they used two measuring cylinders or two large Coke bottles with the label pulled off, fill it with water and cut the top off, so it's like a big measuring cylinder, and they get their hook bait with a hair rig and the bait on it, and they get a free offering, and they drop them in the top of these two containers, and they keep fiddling about with the hook bait until when they drop the two in, the freebie and the hook bait, they both sink at exactly the same rate. And there's, I'll tell you who does that, a guy called Tom Banks, who now owns Savay. And Savay's another story which we'll have to talk about another day.
Yep, this has been an absolute delight, John. Thank you for taking the time and talking to us on the Carpcast.
Oh, I loved it, it was great, and thanks very much for asking me.
And if you're wondering where you can get hold of some of John's recipes and flavours to try out yourself, go to lacarp.com. You can also get 10% discount by using the code CARPCAST10 at checkout. It's stuff I've been using myself all year. I've been using the KS15, which is krill and shrimp. The 15 comes from 15 different ingredients in the flavour alone. I cannot recommend the stuff highly enough, and I am very, very choosy about my bait. You know, the TM1 is also on there, which is a more, the friendlier smell, shall we say. It's like a creamy caramel, and you know, that has been catchy. That one's got a knack of catching uncaught fish. You know, not just the odd one, you know, too many for it to be a coincidence. But there's other stuff in there, you know, some John Baker's original flavours are now on the website, and there's a few blog posts from myself there. So check it out, that's lacarp.com, and use CARPCAST10 on the checkout. So a big thank you to John Baker, legend and extremely knowledgeable chap, and interesting about the flavours and stuff, wasn't it, Mark?
Yeah, definitely, and there's how many different flavours are actually out there, and how many are absolutely useless for our fishing purposes. And sourcing one through Boots Chemist, that wasn't something I'd have guessed, but then again, I'm not in the bait game, or I'm not trying to source flavours, so...
I like getting the people that know about the scientific side, especially bait. We have got more of that to come. Frank Warwick obviously is a minefield, and we've got Gary Bays to come as well. I'm recording Gary Bays in the end of September. I've got him booked in, so we shall have Gary on at some point. It reminds me of a listener's question, actually. Somebody sent me to my private Facebook, a chap that wishes to remain anonymous, but he was asking, let me find the message now. He's been using a certain bait. I won't name the company because we're not here to diss up any companies, but he's using a bait by an extremely large, well-known company, bait company. And in the warmer months, and he moved off it in the winter. He wants an all year round bait for his syndicate, and he moved on to another bait from the same company, and his catch rate's gone down quite severely. He thinks he knows what he's doing on the lake, doesn't want to make an excuse for he really does believe it's the bait, basically, that's the difference. You can never get a true review of a bait because obviously everybody promoting a bait is, biased usually because they're getting that bait cheap or for free. And it brought a discussion between me and him. I didn't know anything about his bait in particular, so I couldn't really comment on that. But we've spoken in the past, haven't we, about certain baits not working on certain waters. And it made me think that there's a couple of things. I had a chat with Kevin about the new Key Cray. It comes out next May, but it's a bit special, Kevin thinks. And I started using it. I caught fish on it at Royston. Obviously, there's quite a bit of Nash bait gone into Royston, so, you know, the test will show when I use it on other lakes, but Kevin's very excited about it. It's one of the, you know, biggest breakthroughs they've had in bait, you know, in a lot of years. He was comparing it to the original S-Mix squid powder when they first got hold of that. He reckons this is as good or better, which is a bold statement, because that's one of the best baits ever made, in my opinion. But it's just interesting, like Kevin mentioned it about, you know, like, it's one thing getting a bait to hammer certain waters, but to get a bait that works on all waters is a trickier prospect, because all waters are different. Some lakes are chalk pits and they'll have a certain makeup pH, you know, the pH will be one thing. And then, you know, you take a little farm irrigation pond in Essex and it's going to be, you know, the makeup of the lake's completely different. It's probably clay and different pH again there. And then you look at a Colne Valley gravel pit or a Shropshire mere that's very silty, you know, they're all completely different, aren't they? That they're on completely different substrate, so they're going to react different. And you know, that's a lot of the reasons why these companies spend the time that they do field testing baits, because you might be able to make one bait hammer the irrigation pits, you know, where they've got a perfect pH balance and great nutrients, but how do they fare on a, you know, a man-made pond that's got a liner in it, you know, and it's just been filled up with tap water, you know, as some day ticket lakes have. Or So I hadn't even thought about that, about, you know, you might even have to dull a bait down slightly just to get it to work everywhere, as opposed to, you know, you might have some of the attractors really work at certain pHs and other waters are like completely different. So have you ever thought about anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. I've been thinking a lot more about my bait over the last few years. And this is one thing that John Bay, I don't think it's on the interview, but one of the quotes I'll attribute to him, he says, if you think you need to wash your baits out, your flavour levels are wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's the pH thing, yeah, I hadn't really paid much attention to, but every bait guy we've had on so far, Mark Bryant from Baitworks, you know, it obviously works with Simon Scott, and they do a lot of testing, obviously, on Simon Scott's breeding, where he breeds fish and stuff, with Viv Shears, the VS fisheries set up. I hadn't really paid much attention to that, as to how different lakes are. Now, have you ever been to a lake where they go, oh, dynamite doesn't work on here, or Nash baits don't work on this lake? You know, have you ever sort of been somewhere like that and had that said to you? Now, I've always gone absolute rubbish. I've caught on my baits on every lake I've ever fished. But would you catch more? Like, so I know a lot of the Nash baits, the previous generations of Nash baits, were a lot of them were based on the S mix. So you had like the, you know, the 4G squid now, but there was previously, you know, they had like the Tangy squid. They had a number of versions of the squid. Now, they're all on the same base mix. So the lakes where that was perfectly right for, and any of their baits would probably also hammer those lakes. Whereas if you get a lake that just doesn't suit that particular bait, then probably all their baits are not going to work on it. So I always used to think that was absolute rubbish when they go, oh yeah, so-and-so's baits don't work on here. Maybe there's something in that. I mean, I still believe a carp's going to eat it if it's hungry and you've got it in the right place. It's going to eat it. It's just whether you know, I don't want a carp just eating it, because I'm really effective at how I'm fishing. You know, I'm making sure I'm on fish and I'm presenting it nice on a dinner plate. I want a bait that the fish search out. You know, I want a bait that they can't ignore. That's when you hammer lakes, as opposed to just catch, you know, when you're meant to catch. I want to catch all the other times as well. which I think a really good bait can do for you. I mean, Kevin's saying that about the key cray, but yeah, this message I had from this chap, it just got me thinking on, you know, what are the different factors. I mean, how can you possibly make it one bait that's perfect for every single lake, because they're so different, aren't they? You know, you've they're different by areas as well, aren't they? It's usually geographical differences, you know, all the Fenland lakes, you know, that I read into how those lakes were formed. You know, they're all on peat basically, so they have a certain alkalinity that's unique to that area, you know, all the Cambridgeshire area and all the sort of fens around there, and that's going to be completely different to Shropshire or to Cumbria or, you know, Lancashire or, like I say, Kent. It's going to be different. So getting a bait that works, you could probably make it more effective in each area if you had. I just wonder if that's something no bait company's ever done. You could make regional baits, a regional version of each bait. Got me thinking. I'm copyrighting that, by the way. Any bait companies listening? You know, and so, like, let's say you have a bait like the Key Cray. You know, you have Cambridgeshire Key Cray, you have Yorkshire Key Cray, you have Lancashire Key Cray. Just a slightly tweaked pH, basically, for each area. Yeah, so don't get any ideas. That's mine. What do you reckon, Mark?
Yeah, I think it could be onto something. Maybe if you just label it up and put the same bait out, and there's a lot of baits catching there. But one thing it does, when you hear people like John Baker and Gary Bayes talk, you know, people should be a lot choosier about the bait they use and go for the quality rather than the cheapness or the best deal they can get. Pick the brains of the person who's rolling it. Make sure it's just not a Fred in the Shed Facebook company who just seen some recipes offline and is after a few quid. You want people who have actually got
that chap that sent me this question. I won't name the company, but he's tried another bait by that company because he gets a deal on that company, and that's exactly what you've just said. So his catch rate has now dropped because he's using another bait by a company, and he's using that bait not because it was recommended, he's using that bait because he can get it cheap, and his catch rate's dropped. So don't be suckered into that. I would like to see that, though, different companies having different versions, you know, tailored to areas, because there's no way that a Cumbrian lake is got the same bottom makeup as an irrigation pond in Essex, or, you know, a peat bog type fen lake in Cambridgeshire.
A 200-acre Scottish lot with a 40-odd-pound common in.
Yeah, I did see that. I mean, what an amazing capture that was.
We should have put that in down the net, because that is, it's not just amazing, it smashed the record by £9.
Yeah, it does. It is a fish that was known about, I think, and it's only just over the border.
I think the lake was.
I think the fish was known, well, it was last out about 30. Oh, no, maybe not. I'm not sure. I forgot. We had Drew. It was one of Drew's friends that caught it, wasn't it? Who came up from Scotland onto the. He's a Carpcast regular. He comes to all the Carpcast socials now. I know he's booked on for Christchurch as well. Always booking himself on.
Has he?
Yes, he's going to. I think he said, "Come to three, get one free." Maybe. <we'll...
laughs> Oh yeah, there was words on the day. Yeah.
Maybe we'll do something for him because he's a top lad. But I think it's. I don't think it was completely unknown about. It wasn't like an out of the blue fish. This carp, but I mean, it obviously was like £9 bigger than the previous Scottish record. It was in a 200-acre lock, and what great news for Scotland. Although, as I was trying to tell him, it's only just over the border from England. So, you know, maybe if we just shifted Hadrian's Wall a bit, it could be classed as UK. An English capture, not Scottish. We know how proud the Scottish are about their heritage. But
well, sitting there on Cromwell when he caught the first fish and broke out his Scottish flag Rubens to wait in.
Yeah.
They just broke out. I made sure everyone saw them.
Yeah, cool. Looking forward to seeing Drew again on the Carpcast social in Oxford. Have we got any more questions, Mark? Might as well do some more listeners' questions while we're here.
Yeah, we have. We've got Rob Winters, a quick question. I'm currently fishing a pretty tricky water. I want to replicate a hatch with risers and a zig bug. What areas am I likely to find a natural hatch? I'm thinking underbushes in the margins. Have you ever tricked a wise fish using this method? Wow, we need an entomologist.
Yeah, that's a tricky old question. I mean, I've never studied hatches. When I used to fish lakes like Fen Drayton and those sort of fen meres, I mean, that it goes crazy at certain times of year, usually in the spring. But do you remember that conversation we had with Kevin Nash quite some time ago, where he's got a friend, I think it was a lady, who's an expert fly angler, and she was telling him about hatches when we were discussing the zigs and stuff. And you know, there's hatches that come in November. There's certain hatches all year round, basically, is what he's saying. That's why he's talking about zigs being such a devastating method. I think you would have to study that. I'm sure you can Google is your friend there and you can find out. But I've seen hatches come up off silt, and I've seen them come off over gravel areas. So I think certain things hatch from different types of bottom. You can always tell when a hatch is coming because the seagulls pepper the water, don't they?
And it's like they're in a frenzy. But, I think to get the answer to this question, I mean, it's certainly beyond anything I can answer, because the nearest I've come to replicating a zig with anything is putting a piece of brown foam on and pretending it's a pellet.
Yeah.
So, but I'd maybe scour some of the trout fishing forums, because that's got to be a discussion they have regular.
Yeah, definitely, because different types of flies, you know, different types of year, and obviously that'll tell you the bottom. I mean, I tried recreating those hatches. Do you remember years ago there was that there was a product, I think, was it called Natural Baits? I forget the name of the company, they vanished, but it was about 10 years ago, and they were selling like ground bait mixes and stick mixes that had real dead flies in it, and they used to float. So they had this stick mix where
natural extracts,
that was it. Yeah, they were quite big advertising all the magazines for a couple of years, and I made a load of stick mixes up out of this stuff, and the seagull, and it was when I was fishing Fen Drayton, it was around that sort of area, and the seagulls did pepper the water just like it was a real hatch. So you can recreate it. I mean, when I was doing my sloppy zig mix on Royston the other week, basically I was using like Nash do what's called a spod cloud, and it's just like a very light ground bait that just makes a white cloud in the water. I would presume it has some like milky powder in it, because I know if you put what's that powdery milk people put in spod mixes sometimes, like SMA stuff, you know, like baby milk and stuff. You put some, a little bit of that in it, it's very high protein as well, and you put some of that in the spod mix and watch how it clouds the water. I mean, you've seen what happens if you pour like carnation milk into a spod mix, which is something people used to use many years ago a lot, and it just really milks up the water column. So I made a mix that had this spod cloud in it, had some sinking spod mix, which Nash do. It's just got like little bits of hemp and pellet and stuff in it, very tiny, tiny pieces, but still like a light ground bait. Then I had a kilo bag of the floating one. And then I put a load of riser pellets in it. Now, riser pellets are all different size floating trouties, basically, where just a few of them sink. So what I found was, if you clump it, if you make it wet and make it into actual clumps, then it all sinks. But then as it breaks up, all the stuff starts floating back to the top again. And if you're fishing zigs or anything like that, what a fantastic method that is, because it's basically like an up and down mix, you know. Some of it will stay on the surface when you spot it, but all the clumpy and heavy bits will drop to the bottom. Then as the clumps break up, it all floats back up through the surface again, and you can recreate that, I guess, with any floating pellet and ground bait. You know, you get it to the right consistency, mix it up, so you know it's quite heavy in your hand, and it's quite, you know, you can ball it in your hand and cast that in, spot it in. And that's going to do exactly that, I think. It's going to, as near as damn it. And then obviously if you can get some dead flies and stuff, you know, something similar to that old natural extracts, then even better. It's even more authentic. But I just think the fact of continually spotting something in that's where you've got food through the entire water column from the bottom floating up all the way to the top and vice versa. It's going down when you spot it and coming back up when it settles. That's got to be attractive.
Yeah, I would also believe all these things are hatching, a lot of them. If you were to actually replicate them, you'd be using a size 18 hook. You know, they are that small.
Yeah, well, the perfect so method.
Creating your own.
Something Alan taught me with the floater fishing is he uses the zig bugs. You know, they're like those. You know, they're basically like replica flies mounted to the back of a hook that Nash sell, I'm sure other companies do them as well, but actually trimming them right down, like, so they literally only just float, they're very low to the water, and that's the difference between a bite, and it changed my surface fishing when I was showed that on I think it was Cudmore quite a few years ago, at the old events that they used to have there near Stoke. And then we were catching these fish off the top one after the other. I couldn't get a bite at first. He was like, trim it down. So it's literally flat to the surface instead of having a big hook bait. And it worked. It was the difference. So, yeah, you could do that with a zig bug fishing it on a zig. Just depending on what depth you're fishing, keep trimming it down so it only just floats. Depending on the length of hookling you're using and the weight it needs. If you're fishing really deep water, you need something more buoyant, obviously. So that it holds the weight of the hook link. But yeah, have we got any more questions? Should we do one more?
Yeah, we'll do one more, and this has got your name all over it.
Go on.
Jamie Shepherd, good morning, show. I've just joined the Far Fen Syndicates. I know you've done a bit of time on there. Any advice?
This chap has messaged me, and I have replied to him. I'm sure it was him. It's not really a listener's question, that, just because it's personal. It has zero relevance if you don't fish Far Fen. And I know not many people do fish that lake.
Well, I think it does have a bit of relevance. You know, the advice, because we fish it for the year pretty similar, and I think his advice, it would work on quite a lot of low-stock gravel pits. Probably don't get a lot of pressure as well.
No, I mean, it's a funny sort of lake. I mean, I fished it with the boat. It hadn't previously been fished. It'd been poached a little bit, but not much. And it's probably a totally different lake now, 10 years on, and I have zero idea about the lake now, I would have thought.
We've got one more then. Do you want to throw that one in?
Joel Pritchard, is it? In people's opinions, yeah, what's better, blowback tube or rig rings for different baiting situations? That's an interesting question, actually, because I've used both over the years. I mean, I use blowback rigs now for 90% of my fishing. If I'm not using a pop-up, and I'd only use a pop-up for 10-15% of my angling, then I'm usually using either a cultured hook bait, which is like a wafter with paste around it. The paste kind of melts and it just leaves a wafter, which is essentially a bottom bait. Or I use a snowman rig, you know, I'll use like a 15 mil boilie with a sort of 10 mil or barrel shape pop up on the back of it. For both those rigs, I use a blowback rig, which is with tube. I used to use silicon tube. I now use the Nash actually do these little blowback tubing things. They're like little translucent green thingies, and they make life easy. I also use it as a kicker on the top of the twister as well, like a line kicker, a liner sort of thing. I actually use one of them. I know Nash do actually sell dedicated ones, but I really like these blowback tubings. If you just push it over the eye, it kicks the twisters just enough to give it that extra little bit of turn. I have used rig rings as well. When I was fishing the car park at Yateley many, many years ago, I got into rings. I'm not sure. Rings are obviously going to move easier up the, you know, on the kind of blowback. You know, it depends if you think you're using the blowback. I mean, the reason why Kevin invented that blowback rig. It was to find out if he was getting done or not, because the tubing can't come back down the hook. So if you've been done, like a fish has pricked itself, shook its head, it's going to push the tubing back up towards the eye, and that's going to stay there. So when you reel in, if that tubing's up by the eye, then you know you've been done. That was why he invented it. With a rig ring, it's just going to fall back down when you reel in. So it's a different purpose. The rig ring is obviously, it's just for the physical blowback movement of the boilie. You know, it's for like hook anti-eject property, isn't it? Whereas the blowback tubing is not for anti-eject. It's just to show you you've been ejected. It's an interesting thought, really. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, actual effectiveness of the rig, I've caught on both. You know, I've caught many fish on rig rings. I went through a few seasons using but it's a lot more fiddly to tie the rig ring. Depends if you think. I mean, I still believe that we catch fish when they lift their head up and tighten the hook link. You know, how often do we actually catch them when they're ejecting the rig, when they're trying to blow it out? How often
probably
does that happen?
Not a lot.
Yeah, exactly. The only difference with a rig ring, is it going to reset? If it is picked up and blown out, is the ring going to stay right up past the eye? Interesting.
If you're using a smaller ring that isn't going to get jammed on the, you know, the kicker, if you've got one on the eye, or you just worse not, then I believe it will. You know, if it sucks the bait, it's going to. Well, it's supposed to be, but looking at them underwater under some microscope.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like you, I've caught on both, and you know, the tubing one, you know when you've been done, the ring you don't. I think that's probably the only appreciable difference.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there is a way to test stuff out, and I've spoke about this on one of the very early carp casts, but back in the day, I tried to recreate the sucking and blowing of a carp's mouth, and I did it with a plastic tube. It was maybe 3-inch diameter, something like that, 4 or 5 centimetres. You know, like the size of the inner bit of a toilet roll, something like that. The size of an average 20 to 30 pound carp's mouth. And got a plastic tube, like long enough to suck and blow, so you can fill the bath up. You can put, like, I don't know, 12 inches of water in the bath. And I put a load of rigs in the bath, and I moulded plasticine around the inside of, you know, to recreate a fish's lips around the inside of the tube, and tried to, you know, like, mould a set of lips. And I tried sucking and blowing on different rigs in the bath. And now, I don't know how similar that is to recreate. Obviously, if you lift it, if you suck it in and lift at the same time, almost all rigs hooked, but not all of them, but almost all did. The most difficult to eject was like the Terry Hearn style stiff link. That was the most difficult, but not many rigs got to 3 out of 10 hooking on that test. There was virtually no rig that was better than 3 out of 10, and the stiff link was the best one. But I haven't done that for about 15 years, so I might have another go at that now. I mean, rigs have changed a little bit. We've got stuff like Julian Cundis rig that he uses all the time, the multi rig. I'd like to try some of these other methods or types of, you know, the popular rigs now. I mean, the way I tie my blowback rig, my stand, you know, the Minnow twisters, which I use the fang twister for literally all my fishing. And there were no twisters about last time I did this. So I would like to try it, to be honest. I might try and get hold of some tubing and do it again. If you go into a shanty cock or something like that, you could use like drain pipe. You could use that big wide tubing. But yeah, I'm going to have a play with that, actually. I'm going to get all geeky about rigs again.
Yeah, if you can come up with a contraption that actually sucks and blows and opens and shorts as well, I'd be very impressed.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think they ever shut their mouth when they're sucking and blowing. But I think they shut their mouth when they move off. But they've already been hooked by that point, because obviously their mouths, their hands, you know, when they're filtering stuff off the bottom, when they're sucking stuff in, filtering what's food, and, you know, blowing back out all the crap, the stuff they don't want, the mouth's constantly open.
Yeah. Do you know what we should do? Like, Joe Rogan does his fight companions.
Yeah.
We should get together, get one of the other, and do an underwater companion.
Yeah.
When we get to, you know, Roger Round or someone who thinks about it a lot, have a few beers and see where he goes.
Didn't Danny Fairbrass and Ali do that for 7 series underwater? Didn't they do exactly that?
No, they did 8.
Oh, yeah, true.
But, no, that's what I'm on about. We'll get one of their, I don't know, get their number 7 or 8, which, you know, on St. John's, and we do catch some good fish, get some great footage. We'll turn them off and we'll give our take on it.
I just had an idea then. Have you seen all those Facebook videos of Aussie Man reviews? You've got the Aussie Man commentating over, like, you know, the bird doing the weather. We should get Aussie Man commentates on Underwater 8.
Oh, yeah. Well, you must have seen that moment where the big plater sucks in that piece of, sucks in the bait and scoops off and dive out the billet, did he? And he looks at the camera and goes, "No way." What would he really said if the camera wasn't there? There would have been a few expletives, surely. They've got to have. Well. You sat in a bivvy with your few beers, the fully plated on your screen. Oh, it'd be madness.
Aussie Man does Underwater 8. I'm going to speak to Danny. I've got his number. I'm going to ring him. I'm going to tell him I've got a new business plan for him. Right, let's get this finished. Carp Talk. Tell us about this week's Carp Talk, Mark.
Carp Talk. It's available from all the usual outlets. What's that? Pocket Magnet. That's $149. Your Apple, Android or PC device. The print version, $199, will be in shops on Tuesday.
Yeah, you can get the pocket, you can get the digital version on a Saturday. You can get it earlier than the Tuesday version. It's only, and it's cheaper, only £1.49. Get it for any device, Apple, Android or PC. If you want to buy the hard copy, there's a stockist locator on the Carp Talk website, and you can find out where to buy a copy. And what's in this week's mag, Mark?
Oh, Rob Hughes names the anglers who are going to win the world champs again for us.
Fantastic.
No pressure, but I think we're going to win because we invented carp fishing, as we all know. Richard Bates is up for sale after more than 3 decades. Wow, you know, the first bully I ever used was a Richard.
Me too. Somebody suggested, who was it who started Richard Bates? Is it Bob Baker, is it?
Bob Baker, yeah.
Yeah. Somebody suggested getting him on as a guest, actually, which if we can get any contact details for him, I would like to do that. I used a boilie before Richworth. Richworth probably the first boilies most people used. They were the first bait company that I became aware of. You know, people are doing these 10 from 10 pictures, actually. Thanks to Paul Harris for nominating both of us. I'm not 100% sure if I'm going to do it yet. But if I did, my first picture would be the first carp I ever caught in a boilie, which was an 11-pounder from Teg's Nose in 1982. There was a bit of a story about this capture, actually. Somebody my dad worked with was a serious carp angler, you know, in the inner circle back in the days, BCSG and all that, and fished on a famous lake called Reedsmere, which was... you know, a bit of a who's who back then. Very difficult to get on. It wasn't you couldn't just join it back then. It was very secret. Had some very big fishing for the northwest. Anyway, this guy, I used to get snapped up by a carp on this reservoir that used to fish. We used to, like, you know, fish 5-pound line, ledger in for anything that came along, bream, small carp, tench, whatever. And I'd get snapped up almost every time we went. And this guy gave me dad some of these, what I now know were boilies, but this is pre where you could buy boilies. And he gave me a handful of these. I ended up catching this 11-pound carp on it, which started my carp buzz, basically. I caught it on a sea rod with sea line, side hooked this poorly, and this guy went bent when my dad told him I caught this fish. This guy like went a bit moody with him and probably didn't expect me to catch. I every week I was like, Dad, can you get some more of them things off that? Off, they were strawberry flavoured as well. Can you get some more of them strawberry things off that guy? And he never ever got any more. Then a year later, you could actually buy Richwith. I actually googled just to make sure I hadn't got things wrong, that you couldn't buy boilies when he gave us those. You couldn't. Richwith started in 1982. I looked on their website the other day. So I am correct in that fact. I use a boilie before you could buy boilies. Only the inner circle knew. I was 10 years old, 11 years old, something. But it did. And then at the same time, I got a message saying, why not get Bob Baker on? And I would like to do that if we can get hold of him, especially if he's retiring now, if he's giving up the Richard Bates. So I bet he's got a story or two to tell about 30 years in the industry. Not quite 30 years, but yeah, there we go. Other stuff in this week's Carp Talk. Nathan Bailey lands the 4x4 at £55 from Kevin Nash's Church Lake. I saw the picture of it. I dearly want to catch that fish. If you don't know what we're talking about, then buy this week's Carp Talk. You can check it out. There's another 50 out of Eric's. Brian Latham bags Eric's Willows 3-scale at £52. Talking of Eric's, did you see the 52 that came out of there a couple of weeks ago? That is another fish that hasn't been out since 2011. If you listen to the Carpcast regularly, you know we discuss this a lot. There's been a lot of carp caught this year that haven't been out since for 5 years, which is 2011. We discussed it with Kevin Nash on the last episode that he was on. There's something happening this year, you know, conditions wise or natural food wise or something that's unique and hasn't happened for 5 years, because there's so many fish being reported that haven't been out since 2011. This particular fish was last out at £40. It's now 52, and its previous capture before that, Crowy had it when Crowy had a lot of the fish out there at 35. They're the only known captures of this fish that they can document, because it was like a new 50. But more info on the Eric's Whackers in this week's Carp Talk. Richard Earle tempts Winton's 49¾-pound pretty common off the top on a 25-year-old rod. You get a story in there. There's a load of features as well. There's a review of Kevin Nash's Royston, which we spoke about earlier. Dan Wildboar's in there. He spends a few days on both sides of the camera. Ian McMillan discusses the trials and tribulations of being a DVD star. And there is the latest competition. This time you can win a £349 Tasker sneaker brolly. Many Carpcast listeners have been winning these comps now. Do you see that picture somebody sent us the other week saying that because we recommend entering comps? He had four or five envelopes that he was sending off to different mags for comps. And then
I saw that one.
And last week he sent us a picture of, what did he win? One of the deeper. Those deeper echo sonar thingies. He'd actually won one of them and sent me a picture of his deeper saying thanks. Surprising how few people take the time to fill in a competition entry, get an envelope, put a stamp on it and send it off. And your chances of winning are very high if you can be bothered to do it. And we want all our Carpcast listeners to win all the free stuff that's out there. So I'll be disappointed if it's one of our lot that doesn't win this Tasker sneaker brolly. But to do it, you've got to go and get this week's Carp Talk. Pocketmags.com is the place you can get it digitally, or there's a stockist locator on the Carp Talk website, or go and harass them in your local newsagent. That's it, Mark. That's it from us. Thanks to John Baker for the interview. And we'll be back. We're on our game now, aren't we? We've got no holdies booked, got nothing. We're going to be doing these regularly every week, and the extra content will be up soon. If you haven't yet subscribed to the extra, go to our website, carpcast.com,
and we will see you next time.
See you later.
Check out the website at www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.